Today on the 21st Show, the Tuskegee Airmen have been celebrated for their military victories and for breaking racial barriers in the segregated army of World War II. But 27 of them went missing in action. All but two were never recovered. Their stories are the subject of the book Forgotten Souls, The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. It's by Cheryl Whitlow Thompson, a distinguished journalist who grew up in Illinois and whose father was himself a member of the unit. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk with Thompson today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey.
At Freeman Airfield in Indiana, typical training takes place, which is being duplicated in many other centers throughout the country.
This is newsreel footage from World War II showing Americans in training.
These boys will fly bombers, the B-25 type. Briefing is important. It pays to know what it's all about before hitting the sky trails with those dynamite eggs.
You wouldn't know it from the narration, but everyone in the film is black, from the captain giving the briefing to the pilots in their leather jackets and the ground crew loading those dynamite eggs.
Their mission fully understood, the trainees don parachutes and get ready for flight. Now they're going to have the chance of putting their classroom studies into practical use, for this is just what they'll have to do when overseas.
These men are part of a select group known as the Tuskegee Airmen. Roughly 1,000 were trained at Tuskegee, nearly 100 were killed, and of those, 27 went missing. Most were never recovered, leaving a trail of unresolved grief that would haunt their families for decades. Their stories are the subject of the book Forgotten Souls, The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. It's by the investigative journalist Cheryl Whitlow Thompson. Born and raised in Chicago, Thompson attended the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where she earned a bachelor's degree in speech communication and a master's degree in journalism. Her career began with the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana, and she eventually made her way to the Washington Post, where she was part of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams. Today, she's an investigative correspondent for NPR and the senior editor overseeing member station investigations. Thompson joined us for a conversation that first aired in March 2026, so no live calls on the program today, but our email's always active, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. All right, Cheryl, let's start with some of the history. What sort of jobs did black men have in the military before World War II?
Well, they had pretty much menial jobs. They certainly were not pilots or officers. And so they did various things, cooks and other, I don't know that you would call that menial. It's certainly respectable, but it wasn't like being a pilot.
Or really having much to do with combat, I guess, with the exception of some of the World War or Civil War regiments. But tell me about the 1925 study that you quote from extensively in the book. It's called, using the language of the day, Employment of Negro Manpower in War.
Yeah, I stumbled across this this report when I was researching for the book. I found it in somewhere in the National Archives, and it was just like, it was a page turner, pretty much, and not in a good way. Right? I mean, most of the things that I read, I was sort of in disbelief, but, you know, it basically talked about how black men were less than, inferior, the brains were smaller, they couldn't lead anything if their life depended on it. It was those kinds of really derogatory and offensive things. And the whole study was like that. It wasn't just like a paragraph. This was the entire study.
It struck me that it was structured like a scientific study, though, right? Although I think today we'd call it pseudoscientific. It even talked about how black men have a sort of a fear of the dark or something like that.
Yes, they that's exactly what it said. Those were some of the things. They had a fear of everything, apparently, according to this study. And it was signed off by, the powers that be. But they had a lot of issues with Black people just being in the military. They just didn't think they could cut it. They didn't think they could follow orders. They didn't, it was there was nothing positive in there.
So who is Eugene Jacques Bullard, if I'm saying that right?
So Jacques Bullard was the first. He was an American who was the first to fly black, but not in this country because this country did not have black pilots. So he was forced to go over to Europe and fly.
He joined the French Foreign Legion. He was a sort of a, what would you say, a grunt, a ground soldier for a while, and then he thought he wanted to be a gunner, and turns out he was sort of surprised that they were going to make him a pilot, right?
He was surprised, and he rose through the ranks. And he actually, on the side, I believe, and you're testing my memory, Brian, but I think he was a boxer.
Yes, yes, yeah, and I guess he sort of proved, he's doing this before that study even came out. So as we're building toward the creation of the units that would become known as the Tuskegee Airmen, what changes in America that sort of makes that happen?
I think one of the things that happened that changed things were the power of the press, particularly the power of the black press, because it was the Pittsburgh black newspaper, along with the NAACP and other organizations, that really forced the hand of Washington military officials and said, you should really have black men. Black men should really be flying. And it was basically a campaign. It did not happen overnight. But they pushed and pushed and pushed. And also, I will say that Eleanor Roosevelt, whose husband was president at the time, had a hand in it as well. She had come to Tuskegee with her husband, and she had heard about these men. And she said, "Well, I hear you guys could fly, so take me up." And I gotta tell you, her security detail was just like livid. It's like, oh my God, no. And she ended up flying with Chief Alfred Anderson, who I always kind of chuckle because he taught himself how to fly. And I thought, I'm not so sure I'd go up in a plane with him, but he was brilliant. And she went up with him, and he took her for a spin and came back. And she said, "Well, you guys can fly all right." And so she had a hand in it too. But what the black press didn't want, they didn't want the army, the military, to be segregated. And of course, it was basically these pilots, these black men who ended up, becoming a part of history, they were segregated. They built an army airfield in Alabama specifically for them. Everything there was specifically for them, so they really weren't integrated. That was their base, that was their home, and that's where they lived and socialized and went to school at Tuskegee
Yeah, and
University.
I thought it was interesting. One of the people you cite in the book called it like an Air Force within the Air Force.
Yes, that was
Yeah.
General Parrish, who's, yeah, it was like two separate militaries, right? It was
Yeah.
like two separate entities. But they survived and they thrived, and they were soldiers, so they did what they were told to do, and they did it well.
Even before we get to Tuskegee, there's an Illinois connection at the beginning of this process. Can you just talk briefly about what happened at the former Chanute Field in Rantoul, Illinois?
Yeah, well, they went there for training. Chanute, I have fond memories of Chanute as a college student, because it's right down the road, and so I would spend a little time there on the weekends,
It was decommissioned
hanging
by the
out.
time I was a student a decade or so later, but yeah.
Well, they had officers. I wasn't looking for just anybody. But that's where they trained and they went to school, and so there were a lot of those men who actually went there, which I didn't know. It's sort of a well-kept secret, I think, among some people, but military people know of it. But that's where they did a lot of the training and schooling.
Yeah, the 99th Pursuit Squadron, as it was called, I guess, launched there March 1941. You say more than 250 enlisted black men trained at Chanute. where they learned how to service aircraft before they were transferred to Tuskegee for their initial flight training. One of the other things I learned from this book that I did not know is Chicagoland, at least, was considered as a potential location for school.
It was. They were looking for a place to build this school so they could send these men. And so someone suggested Chicago, and someone else said, "Are you kidding me? Like, we don't have enough political issues in Chicago without building a school there," because they were looking at putting it near Joliet, where, of course, you know, the prison is. And so they said, no, we don't need that headache. So let's find someplace else. But their official excuse was, well, you know, let's go south because the weather's better and they can get more flying time in a climate that is warmer. And so that's how they chose Tuskegee.
Yeah, I guess that does make some sense, although one can't help but note that, you know, sending educated black men to the rural South is, you know, it's not exactly a welcoming place for educated black men, or really for any black men. Talk
and
about
certainly,
the... Yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No, I was going to say, and certainly not during Jim Crow.
Right, so tell me about the environment in which these, you know, the Tuskegee men worked and trained.
Well, again, you know, they were basically relegated to the Army Air Force, which, by the way, was built by a black architectural firm, black engineers. Everybody that had anything to do with it was black, which is really interesting. And so it was their home. It's this Army Airfield was opened in, I believe it was 1942. And that's where they went. And there were four at the time, there were four runways. And so they took off from there. They landed there. This base had, you know, a hospital, a PX, a entertainment complex, a sports complex. That was their life. And they went to about 10 miles outside of that, because it really, that base was not in Tuskegee proper. It's sort of on the outskirts. It's really kind of in the middle of nowhere. I went and I found the owner of the land, because of course the base closed in 1946, I believe, and the land is owned by a private family. And so I tracked down the owner, and he was more than happy to give me a tour. And so it's really on the outskirts. As a matter of fact, if you're driving, you would never even know that anything there existed 80 years ago. But that was their home. And then they would go in on to Tuskegee. It was actually Tuskegee Institute at the time before it became Tuskegee University. And that's where the men went to school. And there were dorms there. I don't know that they call them dorms, but they're still there. They're still standing on the campus. And that's where they did everything. That's where they learned to fly in various planes. And they did their schooling there, and they socialized there. And occasionally, you know, they would go into town, but they weren't welcome. And when you talk about the Illinois connection, there was General Charles McGee, who was the first one I spoke with of the men who had flown in Europe, who was still around. And he also, by the way, went to University of Illinois in Champaign, and that's where he actually met his wife, and he pledged fraternity there. He was an alpha, and he was the one, because he was one of the earlier pilots, and he and my dad were in the same cadet class, and he told the guys who came along, you know, right after him, like, don't go into town. Like, I'm warning you, like, just stay clear of the town, because the sheriff does not want you there. Even though Tuskegee had a fairly large black population, there it was the Jim Crow South, and they were not wanted, period. And so if they went into town, which they often did, they would sometimes get into trouble. And General Benjamin O. Davis Jr., who commanded those troops, he would have to schlep into town and get them out. But he was very protective of his men as well.
Yeah, you even cite a story where some medics were looking, black medics were looking for a crew that had gone down, and they stopped in a diner to use a phone because they couldn't quite find it in the, you know, to call into the base. This is presumably before ambulances had radios or things like that. And they were kicked out, or they were told they couldn't use the phone, I guess, until they sort of, told what their mission was.
They were the guy who worked at the diner said, "I'm sorry, you can't use his phone." Meanwhile, there's like dead people. And he had later apologized for it after I think he realized, what had happened. But it was sort of after the fact. But that was the treatment they received there. And particularly since some of these men were from up north, it really was a rude awakening for them. I mean, yes. Segregation and discrimination certainly existed up north, but they weren't used to that kind of life at all. And so they took chances that they didn't see as taking a chance when they did certain things.
Yeah, I was particularly struck. You had a couple of men gave the same story of riding a train from, either Philadelphia or New York, somewhere up north, and then they kind of come to a town in the Mason-Dixon line, and the conductor says, "You got to go to the, the car up front that's going to get all the soot blowing in from the engine car." And, when they sit down to eat in the dining car, there's this green curtain that's drawn around them. And it was like it was new to some of these men.
It was new, and particularly those two men were George Hardy and Harry T. Stewart, both of whom became lieutenant colonels. And one was from George Hardy was from Philadelphia, and Stewart was from New York. And so neither one of them, they didn't think twice about it. And I remember when I was talking to Colonel Stewart, and he was sharing that those stories with me, and he had boarded the plane, and he had boarded the plane with some of his white friends from New York he had gone to school with. He was from Queens, and they had boarded the train, I'm sorry, the train, and they got on there. And when they got to the Mason-Dixon line, the conductor said, "Oh, you're gonna have to move to another car." And his friend said, "Well, that's okay, Harry, we'll go with you." And the conductor said, "Oh, no, you won't. This is a colored car, and you will not go." And these guys didn't understand that, because that's not what they were used to. They weren't familiar with that kind of treatment. And so, and Stewart had a choice. He told me, he says, I could have stayed there, and probably been arrested. And so he decided, he thought about it and decided, I'm gonna be smarter, but I'm gonna get my revenge at some point. And he
All
did.
right. Well, we'll talk about that after a break. My guest is Cheryl Whitlow Thompson. The book is Forgotten Souls: The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. We'll be right back. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and this is Lena Horne, who was a favorite performer among the airmen who trained at Tuskegee. She visited there multiple times and performed for the troops. You might have seen the green highway signs announcing Champaign County as the birthplace of the Tuskegee Airmen. They were activated as the 99th Pursuit Squadron at Chanute Airfield in Rantoul, 1941, but they soon moved south, trained at the Tuskegee Army Airfield in Alabama. From 1941 to 46, they flew more than 1,800 missions in Europe and North Africa during World War II. As we were discussing before the break, though, answering that call of duty meant serving a country that saw these men as second-class citizens. They began their service more than 80 years ago. It was only relatively recently in our history that their stories and accomplishments have become more widely known. They were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in 2007. But about 100 Tuskegee Airmen were killed, 27 went missing, and their stories are the subject of a book by my guest today, Cheryl Whitlow Thompson. It's called Forgotten Souls: The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. So Cheryl, when these men do get to participate in military missions, what sort of missions do they get to fly?
Well, their job was to protect the bombers. So they went on reconnaissance missions, just various types of thing. They went a lot to to Austria, Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia. They went various places, but their main job was to protect the bombers, and the bomber pilots were white. And interestingly, the bomber pilots never knew that the people protecting them, these men protecting them, were black until they landed and emerged from the cockpits. Can you
Interesting.
imagine what that was like?
I have
Surprise!
tried, yes. Yeah. Especially for some of them, more than others, I'm sure, depending on what prejudices they were bringing with them. What sort of dangers did they face?
Well, they face the dangers that any military pilot would face: being shot down, being taken, being captured. Surprisingly, these men, and maybe not surprisingly, these men, about a third of them, at least of the 27 who didn't come back, had plane troubles. So they went down and disappeared when they had mechanical failures. So they faced all kinds of things, but mainly, you're trying to stay alive up in the air, and when you have mechanical failures too. Like, I know that there were a couple of the pilots when I started this book. I should say there were seven of the men who flew over in Europe during World War II who were still living, and I talked to five of them and the daughter of one. The other two were too ill to speak with me, but one of them told me that he had the tachometer on his plane never worked. The whole time he was flying over there, it never worked. So he had to kind of, like fly by sight, and it was really very interesting. And he said the day he turned his plane in, the tachometer started working. It was those kinds of things. Colonel Stewart told me that sometimes oil would spew onto his windshield and it made it really difficult for him to see. And so it's just a lot of, I can't imagine. First of all, when I was in Connecticut a few weeks ago at the Northeast Air Museum, talking about the book, and someone showed me one of the planes, and I can't imagine how these guys like even fit in these planes. It was so tiny. And which explains why the guys couldn't be over a certain height. They generally weren't over 6 feet tall.
Yeah, I was surprised. I was surprised by that as well when I came across that in the book. Let's talk about, well, let me ask you about, you mentioned the mechanical trouble. Is the suggestion that these planes were inferior because of who these men were, because they were black men, or, was this a universal issue in World War II?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask. I think white and black people would say yes, it in part was because they were black. I will say I stumbled across another document I ran across was an interview by Brigadier General Noel Parrish, who commanded the troops initially. He was white, of course, because when these guys, became pilots, there were no black officers. So, except Benjamin Davis, and actually he was in the first graduating class. But General Parrish talked about what it was like commanding these guys, and also mentioned in this really huge report, there was a part, I'm going through this report, Brian, and I'm thinking, okay, all right, this is like watching paint dry. And then, boom, all of a sudden, I stumble across this fascinating, thing where he said, there were people in Washington at the Pentagon, at the War Department, who did not want these guys. There were a lot, most of them didn't want these men flying. And so there was someone or some people who said to General Parrish, or he heard it somewhere or something, that said, they had problems with a plane. I want to say it was a B-26, but don't quote me on that. It was some plane that was really bad. Pilots died in it, and it was just a crappy plane. And so someone suggested, we've got an idea. Let's take these planes, let's send them to Tuskegee, and then we can solve two problems at once. Bad planes, dead Negroes, problem solved. No more program. I could not believe it when I read it.
And one of the white officers, and I can't remember if this is someone you interviewed or if this was from one of the oral history interviews you quote from, but said when he was assigned to this unit, he wasn't sure if his job was to actually train the men or to sort of bury the program so it wouldn't be,
Yes.
troublesome.
Yes, that was General Parrish. Yes, that was General Parrish. And he and the men actually liked him. They, according to him, they really had a good mutual respect. And so he really, he was a military guy and he wanted to do the right thing. But when someone suggested that with the planes, he's like, no. That's not happening on my watch. I'm not gonna do that. And he's like, listen, guys, we've got a war going on. We need every body we can, every able body we can get. Why would you guys want to, think like this and do this? But, it happens.
It is hard to believe. We have Yancey calling from Rock Island, Illinois. Yancey, thanks for calling in.
Hey, and thank you for the book. I hope your efforts turn out fruitful. And three things: there was a strength trainer who was a nationally ranked weightlifter during World War II. His name was Rudy Sablo, and I'm also he was an Olympic weightlifter, and I too was an Olympic weightlifter, so I had a chance to get some training insights and advice on strength training from him while I was training at Lake Placid for a special camp. The other thing was that he mentioned too that he was in strength training the pilots, they had to meet weight limits. So he was really on top of them. They had a nutritionist also that was involved, but to make sure that they made the weight when the weight checks were done, and to make sure that they were up to snuff as far as strength and general health. But that was Rudy Sablo, and I don't know if you mentioned him in your book, but I hope you can, put it in your notes. The third thing too, wasn't there? I know you're dealing with Air Force or Army Air Force. Was there some black Navy pilots that were being inducted to fly for the Navy at that time? So thank you for the time.
Thank you. Yes, they called them, I want to say it was the Golden 13, but there were 13 and they trained at Great Lakes Naval Base outside and outside of Chicago, north of Chicago. But in answer to your question, I think it was the second question, there was a weight. Most of these men weighed anywhere from like 140 to like 160. Right, they were little guys. They weren't always short in stature, but they were. Yeah, they weren't. Yeah, they had to fit in those planes. And the daughter of one, Captain Dixon, who was one of the, he was the first one they found the remains of back in 2018, which led me to do this book. And he was over 6 feet tall. And his daughter, he had one child, and she was an infant at the time. And now she's in her 80s. And she always believed that he couldn't get out of the plane because he was tall. And so when he had because he had plane issues. And she believes that, I don't know how she would know, but he tried to get out and couldn't because of his height. So they were very strict on height and weight.
Wow. Thanks for the call, Yancey. Appreciate it. We're talking with Cheryl Thompson, author of Forgotten Souls: The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. So about that, tell me about Samuel Gordon, Lieutenant.
He was from New York. He's from Long Island, actually Amityville, and he was one of 13 kids, and he comes from a fascinating family. His older sister, who just died last year at 104, she was the country's first black military nurse after President Truman desegregated the military. So he's from a really interesting family. But he went down, and his family believed at first, I think they were told that maybe he might have been captured, but it doesn't look like that really happened. But his remains have never been found.
You say he was, so he's based in Italy. It's March 16th, 1924. He's on only his third mission. The war would end less than a month later, and he has a mid-air collision with another pilot.
Yes, with another pilot. And the witness to that was George Hardy, I believe, who I mentioned earlier, who was from Philadelphia. And they became really good friends in the military. And even after Lieutenant disappeared, George Hardy kept in touch with his family, and they remained friends until George Hardy died last year. He was the last of the seven to die. So they are all gone. All of those who served over in Europe, the pilots, they're gone. But yeah, it was, yeah, he hit a plane and he went down, and they've never recovered him. His sisters, a couple of his sisters were, again, military nurses, and there's one left. And she would go over, the two would go over to Italy, and they would always kind of, because his older sister was a military nurse, you know, she was based over in Europe. And when the sisters would go out, they would tool around looking, you know, to see if they could find him somewhere. And, you know, every street they walked down, every time they saw, you know, a young black guy, they wondered, "Are you my brother?" And it just, you know, it just, it's kind of a heartbreaker, because for all those years they've wondered. And his sister, the lone surviving sister, who's now in her 90s, she's a retired school teacher, and she said she still lives in the homestead that the parents actually built from scratch with burned out lumber. And she said, "You know, I kept the same phone number, with the exception, I think they had to change like the exchange, in hopes that if he surfaced, he would know where to call."
And it's so interesting. I mean, this is a time, you know, we're so used to people being available in an instant by text message today. It's interesting to think about how different that must have been back then to, you know, to not know if somebody was a, maybe you hope that he was a prisoner of war or something like that, or, you know, had amnesia, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, no, there was really no way for them to know, unless somebody came knocking on your door, unless you received a telegram. I mean, it just didn't, the communication level was really bad then. I mean, it just, you know, they didn't know. And there was one guy who, John Prowell, who his wife was pregnant with, I think it was child number three. I don't know how he made it home so often, but he did. And he had three children. And it was funny because he knew he was having the third child. And but then his wife, because he was writing back and forth, I have some of the letters. His daughter, who's in her 80s, kept some of the letters. They passed it down from throughout the family, and I've read some of his letters. And after a while, his wife stopped getting letters from him, and she just wondered, like, what's going on? And it turns out that he went missing. So their letters kind of crossed in the mail. She gave birth, but he never got the letter because he had disappeared. So he never knew that his third child was his only son.
Wow.
And so he died. Yeah, he died without knowing.
So just a couple of minutes until we need to take another break, but can you talk about the experience of the families? I mean, what did you learn about the idea of grief when someone is missing versus when you have a body to bury?
Well, you know, it's sort of like these families have never gotten closure, right? They've just never. Now, with Lieutenant, his family decided to have sort of a service for him at Arlington, even though they had no body. That's what they decided to do, because, you know, after these men were gone for a year and a day, the military would declare them basically dead. They were missing in action and then dead after a certain period. But they decided to have a ceremony at Arlington. So there was, you know, a caisson, it was empty, and they did the whole military thing. But I think for them, that was their closure. They'd rather have a body, but they did what they thought was best for the family to move on. But if you think about it, Brian, it was, you know, 70, 80 years ago, and their parents are gone, the men's parents are gone, their spouses are gone, some of their children are gone. They never got to know any grandchildren. You know, the siblings are mostly gone, even though there's a handful still around, and they all still hope that somebody will let them know something, that the military will, someone will take an interest and try to at least bring them closure by figuring out what happened to these men.
All right, we're going to continue after a short break. My guest is Cheryl Whitlow Thompson. The book is Forgotten Souls: The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our guest for the hour has been Cheryl Whitlow Thompson, an investigative reporter and editor at NPR, who's also the author of the book Forgotten Souls, The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. It's about the 27 Black Army aviators who went missing over the skies of the European Theater of Operations in World War II. This conversation is on tape, so no new calls for the hour, though we did hear from plenty of you when this first aired back in March 2026. And we go back to the conversation with a call from Gordon in Northern Illinois.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I remember when the author referred to the Army Manual for World War II, there is also an existing Army Manual for the Negro in World War I as well. And I did some research on Camp Grant, which is the major, injunction point for both World War I and World War II. And the thing I'd like to just point out, interestingly, is that during the influenza epidemic in 1918 at Camp Grant, that was the first time the Army allowed African-American nurses to tend to white enlisted men. And so because of the drastic shortage of people available, that was, I think, a very significant impact. But there was considerable at Camp Grant in 1918. They did have an African-American officer corps. And there's photos where you can see the whole layout of all the people, personnel involved. And over on the right-hand side, they have all of the African-American officers and the enlisted people at the camp. So the final point, I was curious as to how much research you did through letters and personal documentation, because I find that often very fruitful when I'm trying to give some background to the people you're looking at or discussing. Thank you.
All right, Gordon, thanks so much for the call. And just for our listeners' sake, I can't remember if Gordon mentioned this, but Camp Grant was an Army facility outside Rockford, obviously named in honor of the American Civil War General Ulysses Grant. Cheryl Thompson, how about that? Letters? What source?
There were letters, which I was really surprised because I'm thinking, like, who keeps this stuff? But apparently they did. In the case of Lieutenant John Prowell, who has the daughter, you know, he had the three children, when his aunt died, the daughter was cleaning out the aunt's house, and underneath the bed was a suitcase. And she pulled the suitcase out, and in the suitcase were all kinds of letters and paraphernalia and, you know, his college stuff. And it was like a gold mine. And so some of the families did keep these things. There were several families who shared letters and photos and everything with me. So it really, to me, it really helped tell this story of who these men were.
How did you come to be interested in the stories of the missing Tuskegee Airmen?
Well, it started when I was at the Washington Post. One of my colleagues had done this story on the remains of one that the military thought was a Tuskegee Airman. And so he did this amazing story, and the Post rightfully ran it on the front page. And it was Captain Lawrence Dixon, the one whose daughter, I said, you know, thought her dad was tall and couldn't really get out of the plane, perhaps. And so I said to him, because he knew about my dad, and I said, do you think there are others missing? And he says, yeah, there are. And I said, well, that's your book. And he said, no, that's your book. And so that's how it came to be. And I said to him, even before, you know, as I was thinking about it, I said, "Are you sure you don't want this?" And he's like, "No, it's yours. It's yours." So, you know, I'm thankful, because it was, you know, it was an interesting journey for me. I learned a lot because I didn't know much about, I'm not a history buff. Well, I wasn't a history buff. And so I just, you know, I learned so much and it was fascinating. And so that's how it came to be. And I still wasn't quite sure, you know, that was in 2018. And I thought, okay, I can write a story, I can do an investigation, but a book like 70,000 words, it's like that's a lot. It was overwhelming. And I, you know, after thinking about it for a couple of years and talking to people and doing a little research, I thought, okay, let's just do it, you know? And so it was a challenge, but in a good way. It really did challenge me, and I really am happy that I did it. Whatever comes from it, you know, I'm really happy that I went through the process.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Kevin calling in from Verina, Illinois. Kevin, thanks for calling.
About 30 years ago, I met a gentleman named Mike Preputnik, Preputnik, because you can search the story and find it. He was a nose gunner on a B-25, 27, never remember quite what, but they actually crash landed basically at Ramitelli Air Base and had to stay on base with the Tuskegee Airmen, who that was their base, until they could get their plane and get out of there. And as you can imagine, an all-white bomber crew flying into a black base, the pilot had no intention of intermingling whatsoever. Apparently, they were kind of divvied out to the various tents for the night to sleep. The pilot chose to sleep in the mess hall where he would be by himself. So everybody said, "Well, that's fine." And then they shut the heat off in the building. He froze that night and decided he would join everybody. And really changed his attitude about the people around him. So, very interesting story. You can find it online with a little searching.
Well, that's interesting. Karma's a funny thing, isn't it? It is interesting because, you know, these black pilots were the ones who protected the bombers. And I will tell you, there was in 2023, there was the military found the remains a couple of years before that of one of the airmen, Lieutenant Fred Brewer, out of he was from North Carolina, he was out of Charlotte. And I went to his repatriation in December of 2023. And outside during at the cemetery, there was this older white gentleman in a wheelchair. And of course, I had to, the reporter in me, I had to figure out like who he was, because, you know, he looked to be old enough to have been in that war. And so I go over to him, and his name was Andrew Pendleton. And I said to him, like, you know, I told him what I was doing. And he said, you know, he said, if it weren't for these black pilots, I wouldn't be here today, because he was a bomber pilot and they protected him. And he said, I owed it to them to come here today. And that to me says a lot about that war. And yes, that guy might have slept somewhere else, but in the at the end, it was they really forged friendships, a lot of them over the years, black and white, because they you know, somebody saved your life. Kind of hard not to be thankful.
So you mentioned visiting the lands, and I should say we only have about 5 minutes, 6 minutes left in our time. There is a Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site, but there's nothing where the actual airfield was. Tell me about your experience there.
No, there's nothing there. So it's gated off. There's a chain link fence, and it's very overgrown now. It's 1,700 acres. And the only thing that's left, though, what's left is one of the four runways is still there, because the owner, when I found him, I said, "Hey, you know, I'm coming to Alabama. Can you give me a tour?" And he was like, "Yes." Yeah. So I met him at the site, and it was fun, though, imagining what that place would have been like in its heyday, right? Because there were certain foundations that still existed to buildings, right? Where the entertainment complex was, or where the hospital had been. And there was a chimney, a part of a chimney that was there. And so it was just, you know, it was like I enjoyed like thinking about, wow, what this place must have been like, and the life that these men had in terms of like just the camaraderie and being there and their life before, you know, before going over to Europe, before fighting the war.
You know,
But
we're at a
there's
time.
nothing
Oh.
there. There's a cabin there. I'm sorry, there's a cabin there that the owner owns, and it's out by like a little small body of water, not a lake, but some body of water. And he actually said, oh, you know, next time you come back, you're welcome to stay here. And I was like, thanks. But there were like dead animals on the wall. I don't think so. But it was very sweet. It was very sweet of him to offer. And I'm like, no, I'm a city girl, sorry. but you can imagine what the place must have been like 80 years ago. How
Yeah.
vibrant the, you know, how vibrant it was then.
You know, we're at a time when plaques about Black history are being removed from national parks, you know, military bases, Navy ships are being renamed. I wonder how you are making sense of that as you are, you know, launching this history, this, you know, in part overlooked, sometimes overlooked chapter of American history out into the world.
Yeah, you know, I will say that my hope. And I don't know when I came to this realization during this process, but my hope is that someone in the government will say, you know what, these men were important. They deserve, the families deserve to have some closure. Maybe we can see if we can find some of these men's remains, or, you know, I know somebody like Lieutenant Leftenant will probably never be found because my research showed that they actually found him, but they might have buried him in they buried him in a coffin that they had somebody else's name on, and you know, you can't disinter someone. So unless they're 100% sure, he will just always, you know, be missing. But there are some, you know, there's technology has changed so much over the years that yes, some of these men, I'm sure, crashed into the Mediterranean, into the sea, the Adriatic. But I don't know if technology has come far enough where they could sort of go down and see. I mean, they found the Titanic, so you know, I'm not sure if they could find planes. But
That's good. We've interviewed people, especially in the Pacific. There are a number of operations, and the military still does work to, you know, identify remains from that era if they can be found out there.
I think these families just would like some bit of closure, whatever it is, you know, to say, oh, you know what, we found, you know, we found this, or we found this dog tag, or we found something that will give them some closure, because they know that, you know, I mean, all they're gonna, if they find them, there's, you know, they're gone. But they just have never been, no one has communicated with them for years and years and years. There was one guy who's a left, actually it's Lieutenant Leftenant, it's one of his nephews who's an anesthesiologist, and he said to me, he said, you know, I submitted my DNA some years ago. He said, and I never heard back from the military. They never bothered to get back to me. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. I think the families just want somebody to, you know, say something. Say something. They've just left them hanging for 8 decades.
Cheryl Whitlow Thompson is an investigative reporter and an editor at NPR. She's also the author of the new book, Forgotten Souls: The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. Cheryl, thanks so much for sharing your work with us today on the 21st Show. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you, Brian. Always good to talk to you.
I can't give you anything but love. Baby, that's the only thing I've plenty of, baby.
And that is all the time we have for the show today. Coming up tomorrow, actor Jonathan Butler Duplessis attended high school and college in Champaign. After more than a decade in regional theater, he made his Broadway debut in Hamilton. We'll talk with him about his life and work. We appreciate hearing from you about our programs and your suggestions for future guests or stories. Email us. The address is talk@21stshow.org. and you can find that address and every other way to contact us, including voicemail and social media. It's all at our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.
Always pined for, baby, you're looking swell. Diamonds and rings and jive and things.
Oh, it doesn't sell them, baby.
Still that lucky day.